Chapter 18. Sunday, April 24th, 0011, New Era. 1753 hours. 11 days after Siberia. Scott entered the lounge, where he found Clark leaning against the countertop, a cup of steaming tea resting on the marble surface next to him. Scott had been summoned to the room only moments earlier by the captain, a request that tugged Scott away from the company of his comrades in the bunkroom. He didn't mind. Any business that Clark had for him took immediate priority. That was in the job description. The past week had consisted of a stark routine, one that became almost alarmingly normal to Scott. Every morning the unit worked out, and the remainder of each day was spent in personal training. The only new development was the final report on Joe Jansen. According to the base coroner, the soldier died of the silent fever, an illness that had reportedly reared its head in Novosibirsk several times in the past. No further elaborations were offered. The only other thing on Scott's mind was Svetlana. Though she was gone, inside his head, she had yet to leave.
You wanted to see me, sir?
Yes, Private, I did. Come in and please close the door.
Yes, sir,
Scott said as he turned to seal the room. It was an odd request, he thought, but not completely unwarranted. The crew in the bunkroom was prone to ruckus.
Ask the captain if he wants some cereal,
Jaden said as he lifted a bowl of dry oat puffs. The others around him laughed as they reveled in their juvenile banter. The door was sealed shut, and Scott again faced Clark. The captain's face was deadpanned.
How is your shoulder?
Scott rotated his now castless shoulder several times, then he offered an uncertain smile.
It's all right, sir. Feels a little more like normal every day. Not completely there yet, but it's coming.
Good. That's very good. Remington, you know that I expect a lot out of you. I hope I've made that clear since your arrival.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to be expecting more now.
As Scott stood, puzzled, Clark indicated the countertop, where he retrieved an opened envelope and letter. He appeared all too familiar with its contents.
Effective today, your new rank is Epsilon.
I'm sorry, sir. What?
Your new rank is Epsilon.
Epsilon? How in the world had he become an Epsilon? That was a rank designated for officer training, the neutral ground between Delta and Lieutenant. A quick promotion, that was fine, but a leap in rank like this threw red flags everywhere.
Sir, there has to be some kind of mistake.
It's no mistake. Believe me, I checked. I wish it were a mistake. In 3 missions, you've managed to move up 4 ranks. Some soldiers wait years to reach the Delta Corps, and you've flown right up the chain of command like your daddy owns the earth.
A chorus of laughter, unrelated to the lounge, could be heard from next door in the bunk room.
Why'd you do that?
Jaden's voice whined.
I didn't even touch you.
But Scott heard none of it. His stare remained locked with Captain Clark's. Something wasn't right. Clark obviously wasn't thrilled with the thought of Scott being an Epsilon. But it was Clark's unit. If he didn't want Scott there, why had he promoted him?
Sir, I don't think I understand what's going on.
Clark folded his arms across his chest.
This wasn't my decision.
Whose decision was it?
Clark removed the letter from its envelope and jostled it open in his hand. His glare lingered on Scott for a moment before it moved down to the letter.
Advance Remington to the rank of Epsilon, signed General Ignatius Van Thor.
Thor? General Thor demanding his promotion to officer training? That didn't make sense at all. What did he have to do with Thor? Aside from the same welcome that all new arrivals got, he hadn't spoken to the general. Not at all. Placing the letter blindly on the countertop, Clark slid his eyes back to Scott.
I discovered it in my mailbox this morning. I'm sorry. You've done nothing to show me that you deserve this in the least. I see no reason to even consider moving you to Epsilon right now. But the General does. I don't understand this, nor do I approve it, but I was never asked to do either. Apparently, you found favor with the general. Not many men can do that. Please show me that you deserve this.
Scott was speechless. Only the standard military response could escape from his mouth.
Yes, sir.
That's all I wanted. Thank you.
There was a cordial exchange of salutes, and Scott turned to leave the lounge. As he stepped back into the bunkroom and eased the door shut behind him, his comrades halted their levity to stare in his direction. All of them wore etched-in grins. Dry oat puffs were scattered across the floor as a shirtless Jaden knelt on the ground to pick them up.
Welcome back,
Beacon said. He glanced to Jaden.
Show him that thing where you throw your cereal all over the room again.
Shut up! It was your fault!
I didn't touch you!
The group laughed, and Beacon returned his attention to Scott. Scott's expression remained solemn. Beacon sobered up.
What's the matter, Remy?
Scott stood in silence in the doorway for several moments, then sighed over the inevitable. This one was going to be fun.
So then he comes up to us and says, I just got promoted,
Beacon said as William listened from the weight machine.
Man.
He pushed the massive set of weights up from his chest.
Some people are born lucky.
Right. God, how much is that?
630.
Well, anyway, isn't that bloody grand? Someone up there must really like the lad.
William sat up and reached for his bottle of water.
Yeah, well, he saved some chick's life, didn't he?
Yeah.
Then I don't really have a problem with it. I mean, I'm a beta, and I've only been on one real mission. Well, only one that I've been an epic part of, anyway. I got no problem with Scott. He's always been cool to me.
No, don't get me wrong now. I don't have any problems with it at all. Hell, I'd rather be under him than anyone else in the unit.
Well, there you go. Good deal all the way around.
Yeah.
William ran a towel over his face.
I've been meaning to ask you. Where the hell did you learn to fight like that?
I'm sorry?
Like you did in that practice fight way back when you first got here. Where'd you learn that junk?
Beacon fell silent as William stood up and moved to another machine.
Oh, I guess I've just been in a few scuffles here and there. You pick up new stuff every time.
You must have been in a hell of a lot of scuffles.
William sat in front of some pull-down bars.
No. Wait, hell no. You were kicking and flipping and junk. I never met nobody in no street fight who kicks and flips. I know you studied martial arts, had to.
I didn't. I mean, how hard is it to kick, you know? You lift your leg and push.
Harder than you make it look.
Just got lucky I did. I didn't think I'd win when I went up there.
The demolitionist eyed Beacon.
Okay, I don't believe you, but I'll let it go for now.
He gripped the bars above his head, grunted, and heaved down the ridiculously massive set of weights.
God, you're a bloody flicking ox.
The following days passed as normal. Max and Constantine remained in the infirmary, visited on a daily basis by their comrades from the 14th. Max stoically accepted the news of his promotion to lieutenant, as well as the promotions of Scott and Fox. On one occasion, Scott ventured to the infirmary to pay Max a visit, but spans of awkward silence discouraged him from a second attempt. Scott remained emotionally detached from the unit for several days. His unexpected promotion sent a slew of questions his way, none of which he could answer. Though Nicole was noticeably detached, she still offered him her support. None of the promotions were accepted as graciously as David's. It seemed a silent indicator of the respect his comrades held for him, and several times, much to his delight, he was granted the opportunity to lead the morning workouts. This went over well with the crew, who relished their chances to be led by the 14-year NYPD veteran. Scott did get a chance to ask David about the status of his family, and he was pleasantly surprised to find out that Sharon and the kids were handling David's transfer well. They had canceled their move to Richmond to remain in New York, but anxiously awaited an opportunity to reunite with their father and husband. Scott admired their perseverance. Beacon's skills in hand-to-hand combat sparked a reputation surge among those who observed the 14th's free sparring sessions. He rarely lost, and when he won convincingly. Only Dostoevsky and Baranov challenged his level. Bacon's ability to consume alcohol bought favor among the Russians, as he became one of the regular late-night vodka drinkers. Jaden was quickly learning the social skills of an extrovert, to the point where he ventured into a flirtatious relationship with Varvara. One evening, by way of a Bacon-proposed dare, he pinched Varvara's side as she walked past, an action that garnered a shocked, though tantalized, response from her, one that hinted of mutual enjoyment. The distance between joking and seriousness was unknown, though it did begin a fresh set of rumors around the coffee machine. When asked about the relationship, Jaden laughed and refused to comment. The most notable transformation took place in Galina. After the departure of Svetlana, she scheduled a series of personal examinations with each of the operatives for the purpose of getting acclimated with their individual levels of health. It was executed so professionally that it garnered praise from all three officers, and the debate on whether to recruit a new chief medic was promptly forgotten. She socialized more with the men than Svetlana had, and she often joined them in late-night rounds of vodka and poker, though she never drank herself. On one occasion, she snapped at Baranov for his excessive alcoholism, and he laughingly mocked her by downing a bottle of vodka in front of everyone. She did not take offense to the gesture. Rather, she calmly informed him that he was denied his alcoholic privileges for the remainder of the week. Baranov treated it as a joke, until Clark informed him that she, indeed, had the authority to impose such restrictions. Needless to say, Baranov was in a bad mood for the next 3 days. Clark, Baranov, and Dostoevsky grew more anxious with every passing night. When questioned about it by the operatives, they insisted that things in Novosibirsk were moving along as scheduled, and there was no cause for concern. The three officers still talked and joked with the unit, though when it came down to business, they spoke among themselves under a veil of secrecy that the older members of the unit had never seen before. There was concern on Scott's part that he was a cause of their apprehensiveness, though a brief discussion with Baranov absolved him of any involvement. Such were the conditions of the 14th when Saturday, May 7th, arrived. Life phased into as much a routine as possible in a unit decimated by circumstance. The weather in Novosibirsk remained frigid, and the rain evolved into snow. Everything was cold. Everything was miserable. Everything was normal. Chapter 19. Saturday, May 7th, 0011, New Era. 1903 hours. 3 weeks after Siberia. The room was quiet. The operatives of the 14th had been given permission to enjoy free time, so long as they adhered to the 9 o'clock curfew, and thus many were away. Only Scott, Kevin, Boris, and Varvara remained in the bedchamber, with Clark and Baranov behind the closed doors of the lounge. Each of the operatives was sprawled across his or her bunk. Kevin and Boris exchanged hushed conversation, while Varvara flipped through the pages of a magazine. Scott, like Varvara, kept his mind occupied through the pages of a book, though his was his scripture. Lately, he had felt distanced from it. More than just from it. From God. Nothing made sense anymore. Nothing added up. If everything that happened was part of a plan, he had no idea what it was. It seemed as if every time he relieved his doubts, something new was thrust his way. The rest of the room showed signs of casual abandon. Boots were strewn in front of closets, and a concluded game of chess sat in strategic disarray in the corner. For those who chose to spend their time in the room, the organized mess was a welcomed sanctuary. Stretching, Scott felt his neck pop. He reached beneath the bunk with his fingers until he found his cardboard bookmark, which he picked up and slid into the scripture. He placed the book beneath his bunk. A drink. That was what he needed. Coffee. He could already smell its aroma in his mind. It was a walk to the lounge and a flick of the coffee machine away. As he sat up, he made eye contact with Varvara. She offered him a smile, which he promptly returned, along with the word
kofe.
Her smile broadened, and she proceeded to speak in a flow of steady Russian. Scott laughed. He didn't understand any of it. Not one single word.
I'm not that good yet.
She grinned.
I said you must go get some.
I must go get some?
Yes. Sorry. You must go get some. I'm not that good yet, too.
Scott smiled as he stepped away into the lounge. As soon as he entered, whatever conversation that was taking place between Captain Clark and Commander Badenov slammed to a halt. Both officers stared at him as he stood in the doorway. Scott raised up a hand defensively.
Am I interrupting something?
Nope. You may enter.
Badenov remained quiet as Scott slid into the room and shut the door behind him. Clark motioned to an empty chair.
Have a seat.
Thanks, sir. Just going to get a cup of coffee first.
There's a pot brewed. We put it on, what, a half hour ago?
Close to that time.
Scott retrieved a coffee mug from the cabinets, which he promptly began to fill. As the black liquid steamed into the mug, he cast a look back to the captain.
You sure I'm not interrupting anything, sir?
No, not at all. How is your training going?
Scott chuckled under his breath. That had been an unexpected aspect of the Epsilon rank. Personal sparring lessons from Lieutenant Dostoevsky. The purpose was to train Scott beyond his inferior, as Dostoevsky mocked it, education from the academy. The lieutenant made it clear that imperfection was unacceptable. Thus, the personal lessons were born. They were daily and brutal. He had the bruises to prove it.
Painful, but helpful. Lieutenant Dostoevsky is a good trainer.
That he is. He says you're picking it up quickly.
Yes, sir, it's hard work,
Scott said as he sat down.
But I enjoy it. I've always liked training.
That's good. Effort will always pay off.
Scott drew the coffee to his lips and took a sip. It tasted every bit as good as he'd expected. As soon as Scott sat the mug down, Clark cleared his throat.
Ivan and I were discussing the absence of activity lately. Since the attack in Siberia, there hasn't been a single registered Barkma intrusion anywhere on Earth.
What do you think that means, sir?
That's what we were discussing. We've got no idea what that means. That's over 3 weeks, coming on 4, with nothing. Not so much as reconnaissance craft, anywhere. It's as if we won the war.
Scott knew it was a ridiculous claim. If destroying the outpost had defeated the Bakma once and for all, then Eden had seriously overestimated one of its most stringent enemies.
What about the Ceratopians?
We're at a bit of a lull right now concerning them as well, but that's come to be expected. For some reason or another, their attacks are more sporadic, but we've had 2 Ceratopian hits this week, one in America and one in India. Nothing unusual there. It's the Bakma who've got us scratching our heads.
What does Eden Command think?
Command are like us. They don't know what to think. I personally believe they're gearing up for something big. I'm afraid it will only be a matter of time.
Big like what, sir?
Of that, I'm uncertain. An attack? A full-fledged invasion? I've got no idea. I still don't understand why we're still here in the first place. Their technology is obviously superior, both the Bakma and Ceratopians. They can get here. Why toy with us this long? Why not send an entire task force here to wipe out humanity once and for all in a single sweep? Why send ships every now and then?
Scott didn't have any answers.
Granted, most of the strikes are tactically placed, but we've got 2 separate species, both attacking Earth for reasons that we're still unaware of, and neither bringing anything even resembling an armada of any sort to the table. Why shove when you can punch? We're not winning these little skirmishes because we're stronger. If anything, we're just good enough to compete. We're winning because we can match them with numbers, and because they give us the opportunity to beat them. I know they must have magnificent bombing capabilities, but we've yet to see them bomb anything. They always land and engage in ground warfare.
The Ceratopians have bombed before, said Baranov.
Perhaps in 1 out of every 10 incursions, but why not 10 out of 10? Why land in a city when you could obliterate it from above? And as far as I can recall, we've never had a Bakma bombing.
And you think the Bakma are setting up for something bigger?
I don't know.
but I'm afraid that may very well be the case. We've never had such a drop in activity before, at least not after any defining event such as what happened in Siberia. From that day forward, we've had nothing. And that's making a lot of people nervous.
Whatever plans they had, many think we threw a witch into it. What they do next is what we do not know.
Wrench.
Baranov glanced to the captain.
Threw a wrench, not a witch.
Scott looked from one officer to the other.
But this may be nothing, right?
It's possible, but this is very odd behavior, even if on a large scale. It's not to the point where it's making headlines yet, but give it another week or so, and you'll start reading about the sudden decline in the newspapers.
That was the last thing the world needed. The rumor mill was already a driving force in media misinformation.
Have a lot of operatives noticed yet?
I suspect those who pay attention have. A lot of operatives don't know what day of the week it is, let alone what's going on across the globe. But it's starting to draw some attention, even from standard operatives. People start noticing when none of the units get called out for Barkmer attacks.
What about the general? Has he said anything about it?
Thor knows it. He does not have to speak of it to let others know he is aware. You look at him and tell that something is not right. He is a smart man.
He's had Vindicators flying to and from Siberia since the attack, checking to see if anything is picked up there. The site hasn't been touched. It's as if the entire Barkmer army have decided to leave Earth completely alone.
Scott sat up straight in his chair. Brain strike.
Maybe they can't afford to. I mean, aliens have to have money too, right? Maybe every time they send a ship, it costs their government umpteen million dollars, or whatever it is for them. That outpost might have been the most expensive thing on their budget. Maybe they don't have the money to send anything else right now.
It's possible. Anything is possible.
They questioned one of the Bachma in confinement. One of their officers. We cannot understand much, but we've heard nothing of money up to this point. They don't talk much, but it is possible.
It was an idea, at least. It was better than nothing. The thought of his own theory at least gave Scott a sense of contribution, which was far more than anything he had felt since his promotion. Whether he was right or not, at least he was trying. Taking his last sip of tea, Clark set the cup down on the tabletop.
I'm sorry, I think I'm going to catch some Zeds early tonight. I've been knackered all day.
Stress.
May bloody well be it.
He stood up and walked to the sink, where he deposited his empty cup.
I'm going to my quarters tonight, Ivan. Make sure everyone's in bed by 9.
Yes, sir. Good night, Captain.
Good night, sir.
Good night, Ivan. Remington, I'll see you both tomorrow morning.
Clark straightened his uniform and stepped out of the lounge and into the bunk room. The door eased shut behind him. As soon as he was gone, Scott asked Baranov,
"His quarters?"
"Yes."
"I thought everyone slept in there."
"That is usually the case, yes. But all officers have their own personal quarters. The captain has his, I have mine, Dostoevsky has his, and so will Mix. They are just rarely used by us."
That made no sense at all. If Scott had his way, he'd sleep in his own private room every chance he got.
"Why not?"
"It has more to do with the captain. In many units, all officers stay in their quarters. They are like small rooms, but they have beds, desks, and privacy. Clark prefers for us to stay together as a unit more so than many of the other leaders. If it were up to me, I would sleep in my quarters every night. But it is not up to me. And if the captain asks us to stay here, we will stay."
Since his first day at Novosibirsk, Scott couldn't remember a time when any of the officers had slept anywhere else.
Why is he going to his quarters tonight?
"Probably because he is very tired. He does hard work, harder than most people think. He is responsible for this unit, and sometimes he simply needs to be on his own to sort things out. Tonight is one of those nights, I'm sure."
"It must be nice to have your own room."
"It is."
There was still so much for Scott to learn. Up until that point, he thought he had seen everything Novosibirsk had to offer. Now he knew otherwise. It struck him just how much he didn't know. Not only about Novosibirsk, but about everything. For one, aside from their reputation, he knew little about the Nightmen. Every rumor he had heard pinned them as monsters, but then here he was, in the middle of a pleasant conversation with Ivan Baranov, a Nightman himself. A Nightman. Ivan Baranov was a Nightman. That meant, if the rumor was true, that he'd had to murder someone to become one. That was the murder rule. Scott thought about it for a moment. No, that couldn't be true. Ivan was a brute, but he was a pleasant brute. Outside of combat, he rarely saw the man in anything other than an easygoing demeanor. But William and Joe had heard about the murder rule. They'd heard about it from someone who knew. And then they'd told Scott about it. Joe had told him about it. Joe was dead. It hit him right then. Joe was dead. A chill broke out across Scott's skin. Had the Nightmen found out? Had they found out that Joe had unveiled their secret, and had they killed him for it? Scott had never heard of the silent fever before, but he had heard of covered-up homicide. Wait. No. Joe hadn't told him. It had been William who told him. And William was still alive. William was in perfect health. Before Scott could reflect further, the first sounds of life came from the bunkroom. A brash laugh erupted, easily recognized as Beacon's, and the once quiet room livened with activity. Baranov smiled.
Time to settle down, everyone.
Scott watched as the commander pushed from his chair and stood. Ivan was a Nightman. The Nightmen were murderers. Ivan was a murderer. He couldn't stop those thoughts from running through his head.
Good luck, sir,
Scott said, offering a smile. Baranov smiled wryly.
I can always just knock them out.
Scott chuckled as Baranov made his way out. He heard the commander shout a stream of Russian words, only to be rebutted by an Irish drinking song yelled from Beacon at the top of his lungs. Scott chuckled further as the bunkroom erupted with laughter. Scott stayed by himself in the lounge for several minutes, as he listened to chatter flow freely on the other side of the door. Eventually, the showers were turned on one by one, and the volume level descended into sporadic waves of conversation. By the time Scott returned to the bunkroom, the rowdy behavior had declined into pre-sleep whispers. Baranov ordered the lights out soon after, and the operatives filed into their beds. Some found sleep quickly, while others struggled with the ever-familiar restlessness of a night in the barracks. Some laid still, while others tossed and turned on their mattresses. Ultimately, they all fell asleep, and room 14 of Novosibirsk found itself once again surrounded by silence. Sunday, May 8th, 0011 New Era, 0134 hours. That night. It was cold and late. The main airstrip of Novosibirsk stretched out in front of the hangar's giant doors, and the fresh scent of Arctic stillness hovered in the calm of the night. Aside from the faint dusting of snowfall that drifted onto the ground, the airstrip was a desolate span of frozen emptiness. It was almost pitch black, and if not for the dim illumination of the guard shack and the hollow glow of runway lights, only the moon and the stars would have cast their glow down upon Earth. It was in that guard shack that the only signs of life outside of Novosibirsk were found. Two Nightmen, outfitted in their black sentry armor, huddled in the warmth of the primitive building. One was complacent, his feet propped on a desk, and his body eased back in a metal chair. He was listening to a radio at low volume, the rebroadcast of a soccer game. There was nothing else to listen to. The other Nightman was taller and watchful. He was staring out through the window, his arms folded across his chest, and his zombified helmet set aside on the desktop. clunk. Both nightmen flinched. The sound was barely audible over the crackle of the radio, but it was there, and their ears perked up. The nightman by the window scrutinized the landscape, while the other turned off the radio. For several seconds, both men fell quiet and listened. There was no more sound. There was nothing at all. The nightman by the window moved to the edge of the door. The watchful man twisted the knob and eased the guard shack door open. Coldness crept into the room, and he stepped to look out.
"Where did it sound like it came from?"
he whispered. The nightman from behind the desk inched over to the window.
"It sounded like it came from right outside."
The airstrip was empty. The snow continued its steady downward drift as the dim runway lights shone an evanescent hue over the ground. The silhouettes of wide hills loomed in the distance. There was nothing else. Both nightmen peered outside until the taller one finally stepped from the doorway to the desk, where he retrieved his assault rifle and slung it over his shoulder.
"I'm going to take a look."
The other man glanced his way, then returned his gaze out the window. The watchful one slipped out of the door and onto the airstrip. What little wind there was howled around the corners of the guard shack. Aside from that and the sound of the nightman's footsteps, there was nothing. The air burned with cold, and he winced as the frost bit at his eyes. Nonetheless, he continued forward as his comrade watched through the window. The airstrip was empty. He swiveled his head in all directions as he marched on. There was nothing. There was nobody. His pace declined until he drew to a stop halfway down the strip, his attention drawn to the hills that loomed in the distance. Snowflakes floated down around him, barely swayed by the gentle breeze that hung in the night, and disappearing as soon as they touched the ground. His gaze narrowed on the hills. He reaffirmed his grip on his assault rifle and strode forward once again. The sound was simultaneous with the force that slammed into his face. His nose and mouth contorted. He stumbled backward and toppled onto the ground. Back at the guard shack, the other nightman raised a brow. The fallen nightman scrambled to his knees and reared his assault rifle. Then he froze. There was nothing there. He propped one hand on the ground and pushed himself up. His other hand hovered over his face. His fingers touched the end of his nose, and he felt wetness. Withdrawing his hand, he focused his jostled gaze on his fingertips. Blood. His nose was busted open. He shot up a sharp glance, his eyes flitting in every direction. But there was nothing there. Only hills loomed in the distance, and only the snowflakes drifted in the air. All was quiet. He was alone. Then he stopped. In front of his face, splattered unceremoniously against the surface of the air, was his own blood. He blinked as it dripped down the surface of nothing whatsoever and trickled into invisible indentations and unseen curves. He stared at it for several seconds. Then he took a step back. His gaze widened the moment he did. None of the snow that fell over the airstrip reached the ground. Something stopped it before it could. He sucked a breath and spun around to the guard shack.
"No boats! We have no boats!"
Before he could scream another word, an army of unseen doors opened across the airstrip, and he was riddled with plasma. The other nightman's jaw hung open as he reached out to sound the alarm. At that moment, a wave of plasma missiles streamed toward the guard shack.